Hello and welcome to We're All Gonna Die and Other Fun Facts, a semi-regular, occasionally amusing, and rarely funny series of conversations on a random topic. This episode is entitled, and we're just stealing the title from the chapbook, The Almost Sound of Snowfall Falling, and it's about the poetry of Bob Wilicki. And our guest for this episode is someone who knows something about the poetry of Bob Wilicki. Bob Wilicki, hey! Hey, thank you for agreeing to do this.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Matt.
So a new leaf for the podcast. Whenever we have poets on, I say, hey, why don't we start with a poet? Rather than me pontificating about your poetry, why not let's just jump in and let the good folks hear you read?
Great. Okay, I'm going to start with a poem that's actually not in my chapbook. It's a newer poem, and basically I wrote this poem with a lot of worry and things on my mind regarding the country and what was going on. I've also been writing a lot of poetry about my work experience as a plumber, and so those two ideas kind of move and fit together into this poem. It's called Work of Hands. I'm taking my ears off again for the television. Buds from headphones shoved into a place where Patti Smith is screaming. Because 2 minutes from a press conference was all I needed to hear about how the world would end. With another lie under a golden shower in a Russian hotel room. I'd mention his name, but I'd rather talk about Patti again. Skinnier than a flagpole, shaking her hippie dreads on MTV, belting out Gloria and People Have the Power. I didn't know much at 15, but I knew enough to keep the sound down low the first time I heard her shriek. Rainy Saturdays, I laid the needle of her down in my bedroom, set the world inside me spinning. By the time the bus arrives, I'm 16, and there's no two-hour delay, no cancellation to keep the Scud missile school bus yellow from crashing into the glass door of my adolescence. That ninth-grade classroom to be called names as if they were curses, as if it was a power they held over me. I wrote poems to give hell a name, trading punk and weirdo for 20 years in a pickup truck. Exhaust and college blowing out into muddy job sites. Men drinking coffee, running jackhammers, blasting country music, the worst music ever invented. They stand at break and tell black jokes while I stared into a hole even darker. But I'm new at this. In the morning, I'll turn off my radio and go to a place no one wrote a song for yet. Where work waits in the freezing rain, in a ditch line, in that dirty boiler room where a man in a rebel flag bandana holds a ladder for me, asks if I voted yet. If I am the leg climbing up, he is the hand holding on, my foot on the last rung, twisted into a place where the pipe always goes in, where my silence isn't something that has a name. And we go on like this, without talking, doing this work of hands, speaking to each other in the mute language of the body, the hunched back, the shaking wrist, this bearing down and turning, both of our hands on the pipe, wrenching it down, driving it home.
Wow. Wow. All right. Wow. Thank you. Wow. Thank you for reading that. Yeah. And so something I noticed in some of the samples that you sent me, some of the things that I had time to live with for a little bit of time. You know, the interesting kind of collisions in your poetry is that you have this incredible sense of place and then also then the eternal internal landscape. Freudian slip there, I guess. Internal landscape that's there. And I think certainly also with this poem, too, you know, the way that working class identity has been hijacked by just some of the worst people, and certainly people who do not give a crap about the... Oh, by the way, you can swear on this podcast too. It's always it's always listed as explicit under iTunes, even when there's no swearing, because it's just that's another non-working class. But you know, the worst fucking people in the world have taken this, and they don't give a shit about.
No, it's very... you mentioned hijacked. It's also very exploitive, and these people prey on a lot of these individuals that don't have a lot of education, and work very hard, and you know, prey on their fears, and really manipulate them. And I told someone this at a poetry reading the other day. One of the smartest guys I've ever met had a 6th or 7th grade education and could barely read and write. But this guy could open up a set of blueprints and could lay out a building and these complex you know, math problems and, you know, measurements and string lines, and he just had it all in his head. And I'm thinking, this guy's a, you know, this guy never graduated high school, yet this guy's, to me, was a genius. And, you know, that type of America, for me, I felt was being lost. And this was part of how I grew up, and not going to college, not having gone to college myself. It took me a while to find the, I don't want to say romance, but find the poetry in it, the poetry of the ugly, the poetry of the blood, sweat, and tears of the working person, because that was my life. And I wanted to open up the door to those stories and tell these stories of not only me, but these individuals that were building America.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, it's so easy to forget that. And I think, you know, doing what I do for a living is thinking about, you know, the 5-digit paywall that knowledge is behind, that, you know, even what I offer people is behind, is yeah, it makes it ripe for that hijacking and that exploitation. But it also, I think, you know, you've touched on something really important that I worry about a lot, is the way that, yeah, there's country music, and, you know, there's Hollywood movies, and how you almost have people being sort of robbed of and denied culture, and denied that power of art to, you know, understand one's own lived experience and one's own life and the world. And
well, some of the tension where I write from in some of the poems in my chapbook and some of my newer poems come from a place of understanding my identity as a working person, but also as a thinking and feeling man. Yeah. And there's not only a stigma of what a poet is and what poetry should be or is, but also what a man, the traditional roles of masculinity, that, you know, a man can't be a plumber or can't be a carpenter and be a poet, because, you know, what is wrong with you? Because these traditional roles, I come from a generation where those roles were very stayed, and they were very solid, and they were very defined. And to have someone that is comes from that background and have an interest in art was sort of alien. And this is sort of like I love friction and poetry in my writing, and I love tension, and I go right after those topics that are very uncomfortable, and because I want to understand why is it uncomfortable. But also I want to discover, and this is what I really think, what I try to aim with poetry, is I want to discover something about myself. When I feel I write a successful poem, I feel that I'm discovering something about myself that I didn't know before I started writing that poem.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, it reminds me of that. I'm reading this essay about, you know, cultural studies after 9/11, and there's this great essay from the Indian writer Arundhati Roy, and she talks about the role of the writer is to expand the human imagination. And she's saying the same thing. It's like these fault lines and pushing these boundaries as far as what we are aware of or capable of and thinking about. And that's where good writing comes from, you know, to expand imagination. The other thing you got me thinking about is my own father, who was an engineer for IBM for 35, 40 years. And so when he started, mainframe computers were, you know, the size of several rooms. And he would, from best I can tell, you know, using a schematic like a blueprint, you know, because it was a physical space, would climb into these mainframes with vacuum tubes in his pockets to go find the one that was malfunctioning, you know. And, yeah, he was someone who didn't understand art and poetry. Mm-hmm. You know, he liked a good movie, I guess.
Right.
But, you know, my choice to, like, be an English major or whatever, or like books, you know. And I often thought about, like, how much of his life almost was, like, denied him. Because of, you know, believing in that split or growing up in that split and not doing anything to, or not knowing what to do to get out of it. You know?
I think we become very institutionalized in terms of our generation and our culture that we're brought up, and there's a comfort there because there's an expectation, and when you meet that expectation, and you're not expected to, you know, move out of that or do something that is going to be uncomfortable or that you're unsure of. So I think that, for example, if a father says, well, I want you to be a lawyer, and you go to law school and you become a lawyer, you know, you fulfill the expectations of the parent, and, you know, there's no tension there. But, you know, when we swim against the stream and we, you know, I think all writers and poets are explorers, and we often don't know. As a matter of fact, when I start writing, pretty much I don't know where I'm going to end up with. And I think that's where the best creative juices can flow from. And when you're open and not to sound cosmic or mystical, but when you keep the doors open, anything can happen.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's an incredible, you know, what you're talking about with writing, of this incredible pleasure of discovery, mm-hmm. this incredible pleasure of, you know, unfolding a moment and unfolding. I mean, your poems to me talk about also just the unfolding of the layers of experience, where it's like, yeah, you're, you know, screwing a pipe in, or you have this experience, and then suddenly there's all these other things going on, and there's a larger, maybe even political context going on, this emotional history, you know. You know, we're also, I think, talking about maybe this problem of masculinity. Mm-hmm. You know, my father had two modes, you know, stoicism and guerrilla panic. Mm-hmm. You know, when I think about, mm-hmm. when I think about what, you know, that I think is an irresolvable tension that was in his life. Mm-hmm. You know, that if maybe he didn't have time to, or the wherewithal to go on these explorations. Well, yeah, stoicism and guerrilla panic is all you get.
Yeah. You know? Right. Yeah, and I think this is, you hate to say that poetry can be good therapy, but it can be, and you know, when you keep these things bottled up, they can really you know, cause a lot of psychic damage and you know, emotional and physical stress and problems. So you know, poetry has helped me deal with things. My first book, A Room Full of Trees, dealt with my feelings about the death of my father and the whole aftermath before, during, and after. And can I say that I feel better having written it? I can't say that I feel better, but I feel that I've unearthed something, and I've, when I was done writing it, I didn't write for a while because I felt emptied out. Mm. And it was a good feeling, but it was sort of like, I basically turned on the water spigot to my grief, and everything just poured out. And then it was sort of a clean sheet, and I was sort of new again. It wasn't energizing, but at the same time, it was sort of cathartic.
Yeah, I understand that. And I think, you know, there's that value of just putting life and experience in some sort of symbolic order, mm-hmm. you know, that there's a good and a bad, or at least a recording. You know, Jack Kerouac always had that thing about the, you know, the idea that himself is the recording angel. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's really important, especially I think at this time when, you know, those people who've been whose identity has been hijacked. I mean, I think there's also a lot of loss and confusion That is, and humiliation. I mean, there's a great book by a British criminologist named Jock Young called The Vertigo of Late Modernity, and he says that for a lot of people, like, humiliation is just the normal part of their lived experience, you know? And for how many folks, you know, how do you get out of that confusion? And I think these are times of some of our current troubled times are about that kind of confusion, where what is the American story anymore anyway?
It's almost, and I didn't want to get on a political rant, but I feel in a strong way that it's about the art of misdirection. Is let me just distract you with as many things that are going to, you know, make you angry, and then I'm going to do what I'm going to do. And I think there's a lot of that going on. But I'm also seeing a lot of unity. I'm seeing a lot of people coming together. A lot of readings in Pittsburgh, mm-hmm. and I'm sure, and I hope nationwide as well. A lot of us are starting these events up and taking donations for nonprofits and for some of these causes that we feel are under attack, you know, because of this administration. And it's really galvanized a lot of people, and if there can be a positive thing that has come from it, and I think that's a great thing. We're a lot of people are tuned in now and they're listening, and they're more so than ever before, they're watching what's happening in our country.
Yeah, absolutely. Can we go to another poem?
Sure. Now this is I'm gonna read another new poem. And we were talking before about identity and tension and, again, of course, the working class background and some of these experiences. So this poem is, title of this poem is Afraid, and it was recently featured in Vox Populi by Michael Sims. You were afraid they could tell by looking you were that kind of man. Because of the dead deer who dove into the front end of your truck, head first. I saw horns, you said, and they asked, why didn't you stop for the rack? It was because you were shaking and your breath left your body like an apparition. Because you left him there, carried his blood with you on a dented fender, while plumbers in hard hats joked, caressed twisted steel as if it was a trophy. Looked at you differently after this, handed you tools instead of, hey, get this, let you drill holes by yourself in steel roofs, knees bent, grinder bearing down, throwing sparks, screaming into air. Don't say it. Your only defense is to cut metal in skips and burning stars, sharp as the windshield, afraid to say the wrong thing. Beautiful instead of cool and good job. Like how unwashed denim can save you. Stiffen your walk in the harsh, shrill wind to grab a wrench, something heavy enough to kill a man or tighten a nut. Everyone here looking tough without trying. Grabbing their crotches to adjust, spit chew, stare longer than they should at you as if they know, and they do.
So, I know, thinking about, you know, poetry too, because this is another thing I tend to ask all poets, because it's something I'm fascinated with for my own, you know, experiments in writing, is, you know, how do you go from experience to poem? Like, what's that process look like? Is it a matter of sort of a cognitive dissonance? Like, this thing happens, and you're like, well, that was remarkable, or that was... I think our mutual friend Jason Baldinger always says, you know, if I could tell it as a story, I realize it should be a poem. Like, and that's kind of his process.
Mm-hmm. This is really, I don't want to sound pretentious to say everything's cosmic, but mm-hmm. I sort of get a feeling, and not all stories and not all incidents that have happened to me make it into, you know, into poems, but I'll get a feeling or a line will occur to me or sort of a certain kind of weird energy will be built up that I'll feel sort of connected with a story, and I feel like the need, like this needs to be a poem. I don't know how it's going to happen or how what it's going to turn into. And sometimes the experiments, or I start something and I have a lot of unfinished things and it will go nowhere. And oftentimes I'll find fragments of things and I'll put them together into a larger piece and it becomes a successful poem. But it's very hard to put my finger on, but I just feel this sort of kinetic built up energy swirling around a memory or an incident. And I feel that I'm being drawn to write this poem about this thing. And sometimes it comes very quickly and sometimes it's very slow and arduous. But that's as probably as clear as I can, as I can say about it. Reading really gets me moving. It's sort of like I get caught up in the musicality of language, of poetry, of other poets that I admire, and that sort of loosens my brain up, and then I feel like that it's going to flow and the words come a lot more easy to me based on that. Music also, but a lot of times hearing poets read is really effective for me because poetry is so flat on the page, but when you hear the cadence and the musicality of someone emoting and reading their poetry, it's a very powerful experience. And it often, after a reading, sometimes I feel really rude, but I'm sitting there and I'm writing because this is really, I'm having a creative moment because of the experience.
Yeah, I'm with you. I always say to people, right, read well, write well, or listen well. I mean, I know that sometimes when I go to poetry readings, my big thing is actually I drive. That's a big part of my composition process is driving. Mm-hmm. There's something about that, like,
oh no, that's another really walking or movement, is a very important way of kind of kickstarting, I think.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is we need to think about, or I want to talk about is, I think that feeling is a form of intelligence. It can be sort of has this, epiphany kind of overtones, cosmic overtones, but I think that moment of that feeling is a form of intelligence. I think that's one of the terrible things I think the 19th century did to humanity, is sort of split intelligence and made intelligence this kind of very abstract, disembodied thing. And of course is when our university system came to be known as we now know it and understand it. It just so happened that that's when that happened. And it was the same people with that same idea of intelligence. But I think there is something to be said about, because there's that notion of, like, even people who are really good athletically, right? There's a body kinesthetic intelligence if you're Howard Gardner. I think that is a form of intelligence. And it is maybe an extra linguistic kind of thing where if you can't really articulate it, but that feeling, that is a way of knowing, I think, for people. And it's not necessarily right. And it's certainly you can't put that on a standardized test and circle in, B.
Yeah, right.
With a number two pencil. That's not going to happen with that way of knowing, But that is definitely a way of knowing, right?
Yeah. And it's what's strange for me is that it doesn't always translate into the logical waking life. What I mean by that is if I'm interacting with people, I often struggle with, what word to say, but when I'm writing, it's like everything's pouring out and it's right there. And it's just a very kind of odd experience. It's almost as if it's not me and I'm the person that's struggling for the words, but when I'm writing, it's someone else. It's really odd. It's coming from a different part of my psyche, myself.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I recognize that and I just let it go. And I think that's like, it's very important to me to just kind of let things happen, because once we try to interfere and introduce logic into it, I think it kills the creative process.
Absolutely. And I take it there's also probably for you something about like just kind of a laser focus, right? I mean, the house could be on fire when you're writing, and you would take you a little time to.
When I feel that I'm in a creative zone and I'm writing a lot and I feel that I'm tuned in, I'm so hypersensitive to everything, and it's not always like that. I'll listen to a piece of music and I'll just remember a cymbal or listen to like a Mahler symphony or something, and I'll just really just kind of break down at something that isn't, you know, emotionally, you know, obvious, the, you know, emotional moment of a piece, but just because I'm so, I feel like I'm just so dialed in to every experience at that moment. And it's, you know, it's fleeting, but I love it when it comes because it's just, I can forget everything and I'm completely, you know, focused on what I'm doing.
Yeah. Which I think is, you know, brings it to me up another thing I noticed about the poems of yours that I'm familiar with is the way that, I want to say, like, you know, how you make moments eternal in a weird way, and the way that you do unpack those layers is so fascinating. And you think about it, it's so counterintuitive because it's able to, you know, good poetry is, you know, in a sense, taking words away, you know, it's the line break, you know. You know, what's that thing I said about dreams, right? You know, if you wrote it down, it would be a half a page, but if you were to analyze that half a page, it would be seven pages or whatever, you know, it says. And in a weird way, it's like the poet's job is to do both, right?
Well, yeah. The hardest thing for me to learn in terms of growing as a poet, to a large degree, is the editing process, because I had to... Not only, yeah, that's great, I have that creative process and, you know, these ideas are coming, but then I had to move from that other side of my brain to the more logical side and look at a piece objectively and saying, okay, what's working in this poem? What isn't working? Where should the line breaks be? That's why, unlike a lot of poets who prefer to write longhand, I prefer to write on the keyboard because I'm unusually, I edit as I go.
Yeah,
and a lot of people don't do that, but I find that that kind of opens me up as well. But I, when I'm writing, I can see where the line breaks are, I can see where the stanzas are, I can see where I can read it a lot more easily. And I think reading orally is a very important part of my editing process, because I start reading it, and then just like a piece of music, I'll hit a flat note, and then I'll know intuitively that isn't working, that has to change. Maybe if I move that somewhere else or take it out entirely and play around with it. And it took a while for me to just remove my ego and from what I'm doing and saying, look, you know, this isn't working in a poem, even though it came from me and I wrote it. It's clearly not working. And sometimes a poem is better when it's shorter. I tend to write pretty much one page poems, and that's sort of just how I am, and just being comfortable with the type of poet that I am, and not trying, because when I feel that I try to push it past that, I feel like I'm sounding winded. I've done readings before where I'll read a poem, and as I'm reading, I'm thinking, this poem's going too long. So if I'm thinking this poem is going on too long for me, someone else is thinking it too. So there's sort of, there's this back and forth internal dialogue that I go on with myself as I'm editing.
Isn't that the worst, though, when you're reading aloud? That is the worst. I had that happen to me. I have that happen to me. You know, I do conference papers even, and sometimes like prose writing. And it's like, oh, that's what I should have said. That's what I should have said. And sometimes it comes out, and then I immediately forget it as soon as it's over.
Well, I try to... All the readings I do, I try to practice. And then I really get a sense of... Another important factor that a lot of poets who do a lot of readings, I think, are good at is to get a sense of your audience.
Yeah.
Because I'll read at Hemingway's, and then I'll read at a bar. And even though Hemingway's is a bar, there are poems that I'll read at Hemingway's that I won't read at a biker bar, and vice versa. You know, I'll read my punk poems at the biker bar, and I'll read, you know, the poems that I feel more... acceptable, you know, to the poetry community at Hemingway's, just because I feel that the audience and me are part of this experience, and I want to create the best experience for them, while still being true to who I am. Yeah. You know,
which is again another way I think of breaking down that sort of disembodied idea of intelligence. You know, and just you know, genius is off in an ivory tower somewhere or something. You know what I mean? I mean, that's, mm-hmm. that's, I think that's the great thing. And this is, town is such a good town for readings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's so many of them, you know, which yeah. is.
What I love and I want to see more and what I want to do more of is more interactive readings. Mm-hmm. Because I feel that a while ago I did a reading at a library in Apollo, PA. And what mm-hmm. I loved about that reading is after the reading, we sat down on easy chairs, the poets, and the audience got to ask questions.
Mm.
And a lot of readings, I don't have that. And what I love about that is, what I discovered about that actually is that, you know, a lot of people have, after they hear you, they have a lot of questions because, you know, you've really compelled them with something or they connected with a piece of writing. They want to ask you questions about it. And a lot of readings, you know, the poet gets up and reads, and then there's kind of this wall here after that. The reading's mm-hmm. over and we're having champagne and we're signing books. But or we're not talking about the work often.
Yeah.
And that's why I like to, I don't try to do it all the time, but I make a point. I really try, you know, intentionally to listen. And if the moment presents itself and it's appropriate, I'll go up to the poet and I'll say, I really loved the movement in your poetry, or I really loved the language in your poetry, or you seem to be writing a lot about this, and I really, you know, like that, or I really felt that, you know, you were connecting with me on that level, on that experience, and try to, and I found that a lot of poets are just, they're not shocked, but they're pleasantly surprised, and they genuinely thank me, and I thank you for listening. And I'm not saying that everyone doesn't listen, but sort of like this is, you know, the social experience of going to a poetry reading is the audience is here and the poet is here.
Yeah.
But I want to bring that together. And part of what I started with my series, Versify, is I wanted to do something a little bit different because I was noticing that when I started to gain confidence, I had a chapel guide, I started to do readings, I noticed that there were certain factions in the community that were reading together. Mm. And they were friends, of course, and I understand that. And there were college MFA groups, they were reading together. There were sort of bohemian poets that weren't attached to a college, they were reading together. There were the mad women in the attic who, you know, women poets, they were reading together. And so what I wanted to do with my series is I wanted to kind of break down those barriers and I wanted to put those people together. And surprisingly, it worked. Sometimes the experiment doesn't work, but I like to create an experience, a reading that is sometimes greater than the sum of its parts.
Mm-hmm.
I'll put three people or four people together that have never read together, but I try to read their work and I find sort of things that are in common and they have an aesthetic kinship. And that excitement and tension sometimes really creates an interesting reading. And in addition to that, instead of the reading of the bio to introduce the poets, oftentimes what I'll do is I'll ask the poets to exchange poems with each other. And based on the order they're going to read, as an introduction, that poet will read a poem of another poet. So they get to hear it in someone else's voice.
Oh, wow.
And that is a really cool experience because that poet is going to read that poem differently. Mm-hmm. And I've had people come up to me and they says, I've changed my poem because of how this person read my poem that I never would have heard it, you know, or in my mind read that way. And it's really, it also creates a bond with the poets too. And they feel that they understand each other's work on a deeper level, I think.
Yeah, which is, you know, it's also a thing about, you know, writing can be this single solitary act and mm-hmm. a very intimate act. You know,
yeah.
and it people is, but, sort yeah. of sharing their intimacy, yeah. And then it's like that leap of then making that public or making that, you know, or even sort of sharing with the people, you know, is you know, Emily Dickinson, right?
Yeah. You know? I don't know who said this, but I heard someone say that a poem has several lives, once when it's read, once when it's written, and another when it's spoken aloud, and that's very true. Mm-hmm. You know, I think if we don't read our poems out loud to people, they die a little.
Yeah.
You know, they're meant, poetry's meant to be shared.
Yes. Yeah. And so, speaking of which, so your next reading, personal reading, right, is at City of Asylum, October 26, 2017. I gotta say 2017 because the internet supposedly is forever until we get hit by that solar flare, I guess. At 8 p.m. at City of Asylum Books. And you'll be reading with, forgive me,
Angel Ellis and Nancy Chen Long, two wonderful poets. And it's going to be a theme of identity. I'm going to write about, I'm going to read poems based on work and class identity. And Nancy and Angel are going to read poems based on cultural and ethnic identity and other issues as well. So I'm really looking forward to that. I've been a volunteer at City of Asylum for a number of years, and I love their mission.
Yeah,
and you know, they're doing great things with that space, and it's really, we're really fortunate as writers and poets to live in Pittsburgh in such a vibrant community.
Absolutely. And so, and also there's the
Versify.
Yeah. Oh my God. Versify. My handwriting is so bad. Reading series, which I believe there's a Facebook page for that.
Yes. It's at Get Versified. It's really pretty easy to find.
Yeah.
And
I'll share that link.
Mm-hmm. Great.
On the podcast and the tags and all the other things. And also, we should talk about your chapbook, which I believe you have open. So you read something from the chapbook, maybe. It's called a hard plug, people. We're just over. He's going to read something from his wonderful chapbook, the almost sound of snow falling, right?
Yes. I'm really happy with the job that Diane Borsnick from Night Valley Press out of Ohio did on this book. And so I'm going to switch gears from the work poems. We had talked about our fathers and some of the things that we felt were kind of holding them in a box. And so I'm going to read one of these poems. It's about my grandfather, and it's called Anesthesia. Hemp rope muscles twist, tie themselves with little effort. Just sitting here at Connolly's bar is enough to tighten the knot. Even after last call, doors locked, the ghost of his sweat haunts this oak. Worn bar tops where he rested his denim arm. Few bills earned him his medicine, amber-tinged, sour mash, anything cheap, domestic, whatever was on tap. Clank of dirty glassware, laughter, ripped leather bar stools and piss troughs at his feet. At 8, I remember how my grandfather's breath took my breath away. I wrecked my BMX in thick hollows while he fell daily in the made-up dust of B-movie westerns, John Wayne, bar fights, and gunfire. I poured Pabst Blue Ribbon in baby cups for him, like my grandmother told me to. Spill-proof plastic for his shaking hands. Every time he closed his eyes, he went somewhere. Ghost towns, the bar at the end of the street. I pushed the drapes back, left his bedroom lights on, so he could find his way back home.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Thanks.
Yeah, wow. I got nothing, folks. No, I just, wow. Wow.
Yeah. One thing with writing these poems is I struggled with initially was, do I have the right to write about this person's life this way, to be this candid and this open. But in a sense, I'm always saying a prayer for them in a poem. This is how I look at it. I look at it as sort of, this is the highest tribute that I can do for a person is to write a poem about them.
Yeah.
Because where there's pain and where there's suffering, there's also love.
Yeah.
And I think that's the highest act of devotion I can do is write a poem.
Yeah, and that love is, you know, there's that difference between love and infatuation. You know, infatuation is when you filter out, you know, anything negative, anything painful, and you only see one side. And, you know, I'm sure we've all seen that in the lives of our friends, right? You know,
oh yeah,
they think they're in love, but they're in infatuation.
And I always, whenever I watch a program, or, you know, if I've gone to a funeral where someone's doing a eulogy and they're talking about this person, what a great person they were, and maybe they were, but sometimes I think, are we romanticizing this person because they're no longer with us?
Yeah.
And this is what something I really tried to work against. But again, it's a very careful balance, because with our pain comes anger, and sometimes the anger is misdirected and sometimes it isn't. But in the same breath, when we put anger in our poems and we start judging and naming and blaming folks in poems, that's when I think it can get dangerous, and it doesn't serve the poem well. And I always wanted to leave things open in the poem, because I don't want to judge. I just want to hold up a mirror, and I want everyone else that is encountering the poem and reading the poem and interacting with it to have their own encounter with it.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, to have the honest mirror, I think, is also to, you know, reclaim that humanity. You know, I mean, for me, all art does come down to, and I apologize to regular listeners of the podcast because they probably heard this story before, you know, it's those cave paintings in France where people just left their handprints 30,000 years ago, you know, and to think about that handprint as a gesture of, I am somebody, I was here, you know, and to understand people and to be able to identify. I think there's also in that poem and a lot of your other poems, the capacity to identify with, you know, which is something I think that is so lacking in our culture these days, to identify with all aspects of other people, you know. And again, I think it's something that all art, poetry especially, I think has this incredible power to do for people.
Yeah, the highest compliment that I can receive after reading is, and it's happened a couple of times where someone comes up to me, and even if it's one person, especially if it's one person, it's usually one person that will come up to you and they'll say, I don't know about your other poems, but that poem killed me, or that poem made me think of my father, or that poem haunted me when you read it, and I will remember that poem. I had a woman, I don't have the poem with me, but I wrote a poem about my other grandfather, who was a war veteran, and based on a picture of a woman who was holding a picture of her father in his Navy uniform. And after it was published, I think, in the Post-Gazette, and after she read it, she wrote to me and she said, can you send me, could you email me that poem? I read it, but I didn't save the paper. And she says, I'm putting this poem on my refrigerator, because every time I read it, I think of my grandfather and his war experiences and everything he went through. And that's just, it doesn't get any better than that.
No, you know, it really,
you know,
doesn't.
We worry, you know, and I was talking to a friend the other day about acceptances and rejections and manuscript submissions and all this other bullshit. But, you know, when you get a compliment like that, this is why we write.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because we're in the business of human lives, you know, to like steal a sort of like line from Charles Dickens, but it's like, we're in the business of humanity. You know, this is why poets are put on this earth, you know, to not only be a mouthpiece for a generation and to you know, say what others can't say or won't say, but also to touch people.
Yeah.
And make them feel they're not alone.
Absolutely. And it's such a strange, seemingly counterintuitive thing. It's almost like that wintertime driving thing. You turn into the skid, right?
Mm-hmm.
The more personal it becomes, the more universal it becomes at the same time. And that's so weird, but I think so true, right?
I think people not only really admire and respect that you're up there in front of strangers, or you're up there in front of whomever, and you're reading this damn personal poem. There's that. There's that admiration. But there's also that, I think, because poetry is such an intimate experience that I feel that writing about those intimate experiences, I think, comes natural to the art form. Mm-hmm. And people, I think people gravitate to that because we are feeling people. You know, there are other poets that write from other perspectives and have different aesthetics, and that's fine too. Yeah. I need to feel moved, and I need to move when I write. And this is something that I recognized. Everyone recognizes where they feel that they're the strongest at, and this is something that I feel that is part of who I am, and I just need to keep on doing it.
I don't know, can we have one more poem before the bottom five? Because just...
Absolutely. You were talking about cave paintings, and I said, oh, I want to read this one because it's about painting. And I've always struggled with writing love poems because I think they fall into too many traps. This is a love poem. This is for my wife, and this is about an experience we had painting a house for some extra money. It's called First Coat. We do it, as they say, for the money. You transformed in 5 minutes from business to babushka, gabardine slacks to a paint-specked tee. I stir color in a five, the faintest coral till it's buttery smooth, till the dizzy buzz of paint fills our noses in the room with its slick skin, till the walls sweat with our labor. Talk soon gives itself away to music, static radio, and the sticky pull until a ceiling is covered, overlapping the lines I made to the brush's stiff edge. Each 15 by 20 room we do is a cable bill. Each bathroom ceiling a steak dinner. Every color must be stared at 100 times, every drip and wet smudge caught before it falls, and still neither of us can trust what we see. Like grief, color dries in stages, the thin gray veil of the past disappearing under newer white, fading back and forth until we keep shifting on tired legs, wet rollers in our hands, second-guessing whatever we've done, what we've lost, everything we love. And suddenly we can barely feel it when the first pass leaves the wall glistening, then fades true. We're unsure of it, how it will look in the morning. We stand back from ghost white walls, satisfied when pistachio green has become porcelain, amaretto cream. Each color name fills the distant taste of French coffee in our mouths, the Paris wind in our faces. We work at it until dark, our faces flecked with semi-gloss and all that natural light fading until last we lose it. Time to hammer those lids down again, run that water till our brushes are clear.
Robert Wilicki, folks. You can hear more Thursday, October 26, 2017 at 8 p.m. at the City of Asylum Bookstore. There's also the Versify reading series and the wonderful books The Almost Sound of Snow Falling and A Room Full of Trees, right?
Yes.
Yes. And on that happy note, it's time for the bottom five. Bottom five is a series of questions not related to our main topic that are of a surrealistic or philosophical nature. Are you ready?
No, but go ahead.
All right. Question one. If reincarnation is real and you had to come back as an infectious disease or illness, what kind of disease or illness would you be?
Wow.
You had to go single cell.
What kind of infectious disease would I like to be? This is kind of a really lame answer.
There are no lame answers to this question. It's a weird question.
I had mono once.
Mm.
All right. Now, unfortunately, it moved in a very dangerous area and created encephalitis, which I would not want to come back as.
Yeah.
But I'd want to come back as mono because I have the fond memory I have of mono initially was I was very young, and it meant that I didn't have to go anywhere, and I could just lay on the couch and just veg. So I would like to just infect people and just experience their malaise and their just relaxation.
That's a great answer, man. That is a great answer. All right, question two. In anticipation of our eclipse in a few days, if you had to choose, would you welcome the total elimination of day or of night? Or maybe another way to think about it, if the world were to stop spinning, would you hope you're on the dark side of the earth or the light side of the earth? Provide, I mean, we'd all be killed, but if the earth stopped spinning. But if you're rooting for one.
If I'm rooting for one.
Yeah. Total day or total night.
Would the night last an entire day?
Night would be eternal. That would be it. There would be no more day ever. There would be no more sunlight, no more sunburns.
Mm-hmm.
No more grown food, but we'll get around that. You know, we'll hook up some lights and stuff, you know.
I would pick night because I think that I feel I'm a more nocturnal person, and I think the magic happens at night. And
yeah.
there is more, that's when the concerts are going on, and that's when just like, you know, it's sort of, okay. I'm a big fan of the whole jam band music category. And what I love about the whole sort of process is sort of the way that a lot of these bands, you know, have these concerts. They'll have a first set. And oftentimes that'll be during the day. And it's kind of like brief songs, 4 or 5 minute songs. But then the second set is when they really start opening up and things get really cosmic and jamming, and songs are 20 minutes long, and it's night, and the stars are out, and it's a more magical time for me. So yes, night.
There we go. That's a good one. All right, question three. Have you ever had a dream you wish you could revisit, or a dream world you wish you could periodically revisit from time to time?
That's a tough one because I'm gonna have to really dig deep, because often I don't remember my dreams a lot, and I think my explanation for that, and it may be, you know, incorrect, is that because I write and because I'm using a lot of, you know, I'm dreaming during the day, I feel that I'm not doing it at night. But if I had to relive a dream, man, I have a lot of nightmares, so.
Yeah, don't want those.
When I have a positive dream, I'm usually in a space or a place that I would just, if I died there, I would be happy. And that's usually by the ocean or by some form of water that I feel that is like, I'm drawn to, I need to be near water. I don't know what it is. So, one of my favorite places in the world is Ocean City, Maryland, and someone just, there was just a horrible accident very recently, and it just kind of like really ruined my thought about Ocean City, but someone died. A young girl was walking on the beach in the morning, and she fell into a hole, and sand collapsed on her, and she suffocated in sand, and I'm thinking, wow.
Wow.
But that's a really weird answer, but I don't know if I'm answering your question, but...
Water. All right. So speaking of nightmares, question four. If we're living in a dystopian future, all right, not this one, but like another one, or another alternative dystopian future. And in this dystopian future, the only books to survive would be those bound in human skin. Basically, they're doing a book purge, and there's the bonfire of the books, and then there's the tannery. The question is, faced with the total elimination of a volume for all of human history, would you, you know, march with this book into the tannery? And if so, what book would you donate your skin for? And with the caveat, somebody's already taken the Bible, the Quran, and the complete works of Shakespeare. Those are off the table. Easy answers. Somebody already did those. So would you...
Wow.
you know, sacrifice your skin so that a text could survive into the human future? And if so, what book?
Wow, that's a really... That's so unfair.
Sorry, I know you got to pick one.
I don't know if I can. I was going to say something, but it would be the most pompous answer ever, but...
It's all right. We're on a podcast. We're recording our conversation and other people offering it to other people. I think there's something pretty pompous about that.
Well...
Right.
Based on the fact that everyone else is doing the same thing and picking books, there's a good chance that other books that I would like would survive.
This is true.
So, I think a good answer would be my own book, and I don't know which one or when or if I had an opportunity to put all my best writing into one book, and it's important to me not the fact that I don't have children. It's important to me that I leave something here. Whether anyone cares or reads it or not is another thing, but it's just important for me that there's some evidence that I lived here and that I contributed in some small way to this art.
Handprint on a French cave.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly, right? No. We're back to the end, hey.
Who's, would it be my skin?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. And I think too, it also this theme, you know, it is really our main theme then in the way in which the depth of your experiences do fit in this. So yeah, skin, depth. Yeah, it would make sense.
Okay.
Skin, depth, tannery, you know, whatever.
What would those books, not to hijack your questions, but what would those books called where they use human skin? Wasn't there a name?
There is a name. I should know this because I asked this question. There is a name, and there was a Slate article, because Harvard does own a couple books.
Wasn't it tied in with some kind of real-life supernatural experience? One of those Haunting in Connecticut stories or something?
Yeah. So there's a name. Google it, people. You know, leave in the comments, or not. No, never read the comments. There are no comments to read, so that's the best. All right, finally, number five. This is sort of related, I think, to the poem, too. What mundane daily activity gives you the most joy?
Sitting down with a drink and listening to music.
That is pretty good. That's hard to beat. That is hard to beat.
If I could come back and do something else other than writing... It would be to be a musician because I just, you know, music, I cannot live without music.
Yeah. Yeah. What a horrible existence without music. All right. Robert Wilecki, thank you so much for doing this again. City of Asylum, Thursday, October 26th at 8 p.m. You'll be reading. There's the Versify reading series and the wonderful books, A Room Full of Trees and The Almost Sound of Snow Falling. Thank you so much for doing this. Links will, of course, be on our website. And I think that's about it. Our next episode will eventually happen, and it will be about something, I guess. Our homepage, where you can find new and old episodes, is GonnaDiePodcast.com. We're also on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at GonnaDiePodcast, and We're All Gonna Die is on Facebook. Later, meets.